Hi folks, and welcome to the fourth installment of House Therapy, Discovering Who You Really Are at Home. Today we're going to look at the bedroom. The bedroom is what I like to think is home to our inner prince or princess of the underworld. Here we find the nascent and sensitive self who passes back and forth between our states of consciousness. I suppose the most famous bedroom princess is Persephone, Demeter's daughter, who was snaffled by Hades, god of the underworld, whilst playing in a flowering meadow, and taken to his dark kingdom where she ate pomegranate seeds, and thus was condemned to remain there for the most part of each year, to eat of the fruit of love with the dark lord and to consume his seed. Persephone becomes the goddess of spring, as it is then that she is able to return to the world above and so brings new life back from the inchoate darkness of the unknown. A very apt metaphor for our own unconscious realms and the role it plays in our lives and especially in our creative dimensions. This perspective on life is like those represented by the myths of creation, where the sun god passes into becoming the moon goddess as day passes into night. The cyclical acceptance of life into death and back into life again, as we are reborn each morning upon awakening. Joseph Campbell, the late great mythologist, states, "As the consciousness of the individual rests on a sea of night into which it descends in slumber and out of which it mysteriously wakes, so in the imagery of myth the universe is precipitated out of and reposes upon a timelessness black into which it again dissolves, and as the mental and physical health of the individual depends on an orderly flow of vital forces into the field of waking day from the unconscious dark, so again in myth the continuous of the cosmic order is assured only by a controlled flow of power from the source. The gods are symbolic personifications of the laws governing this flow. The gods come into existence with the dawn of the world and dissolve with the twilight. They are not eternal in the sense that the night is eternal. Only from the shorter span of human existence does the round of cosmogonic eon seem to endure." All cultures and civilizations have creation myths to explain the movement of the planets, night and day, and sleep and wakefulness. It is a magical time, the natural periods between the two states of our consciousnesses, twilight in the evening as the sun begins to go down, and pre-dawn, just before the sun rises in the sky. This is the time for our princess of the underworld, and her locale is the bedroom. At these in-between times, things are not quite so clearly defined, are they? There is an indistinctness about reality, a shadow world of things emerging and dissolving. Our inner princess can almost be childlike in her playful attitudes towards what is and what isn't, a bit like the gods Loki from the Norse pantheon of gods and Hermes from the Greek. These were playful and tricky entities. Both were messenger gods who had access to both worlds, the underworld and to Asgard in Loki's case, and to Olympus in Hermes, where the gods lived and played. The Hellenistic underworld was ruled by Hades and the Norse by Hel. So you can see where our Christian underworld myths have appropriated these names from. You can also see how closely death and sleep have been associated by all our early cultures as they journeyed to understand the different states of human consciousness. Our bedroom is fundamentally a place which contains a bed and where we go to sleep. It is a portal between worlds of the conscious and the unconscious. It is our temple of sleep, where we go after our day's labour and nightly feast to lie prostrate upon a flat couch and quietly beseech the god of the underworld to come and take us to his realm. It is interesting to examine the bedroom in these terms, to see its function in light of the split between these states of being. I think we would all agree that we rescind our autonomy when we go to sleep, and our consciousness is removed into the ocean-like world of dreams. We no longer have the illusion of being totally in control of our lives and destinies. I think it is useful here to look at our experience of going to sleep as small children, when it is universally something that we are afraid of, and we want our mummies and daddies to stay with us until we have fallen asleep. Why is that, I wonder? What are we afraid of? I think that it may be that at this early age we sense that we did not exist, or at least had no identity not so long ago, and that sleep is like a return to that state of nothingness and sense of no self. I remember that magical moment when my children were first born and their eyes sprang open, and looking into that sentient consciousness for the first time, I wondered about their own awareness of who they were and where they had come from, of what consciousness actually is and where it goes to in sleep and then in death. I think deep down that we fear our own non-existence when we approach sleep sometimes, and that children do more generally. It is an unspoken fear of the one dissolving into the sea. I hear the plaintive voice say, "Please leave the light on, Daddy. Don't leave me here in the dark, awaiting sleep, waiting for the unknown to come and get me, for Hades to ride in on his deathly chariot and spirit me off to the underworld." I know not whether my reader is aware that many children have a power of painting, as it were, upon the darkness all sorts of phantoms. In some, that power is simply a mechanic affectation of the eye. Others have a voluntary or semi-voluntary power to dismiss or summon such phantoms, or, as a child once said to me when I questioned him on this matter, "I can tell them to go, and they go, but sometimes they come when I don't tell them to come." He had by one half as unlimited a command over apparitions as a Roman centurion over his soldiers. In the middle of 1817, this faculty became increasingly distressing to me at night when I lay awake in bed. Vast processions moved along continually in mournful pomp, friezes of never-ending stories that to my feelings were as sad and solemn as stories drawn from times before Oedipus or Priam, before Tyre, before Memphis. And concurrently with this, a corresponding change took place in my dreams. A theatre seemed suddenly opened and lightened up within my brain, which presented nightly spectacles of more than earthly splendour, and the four following facts may be mentioned as notable at this time. 1. That, as the creative state of the eye increased, a sympathy seemed to arise between the waking and the dreaming states of the brain in one point, that whatsoever I happened to call up and to trace by a voluntary act upon the darkness was very apt to transfer itself to my dreams. And at length I feared to exercise this faculty, for as Midas turned all things to gold, that yet baffled his hopes and defrauded his human desires, so whatever things capable of being visually represented I did but think of in the darkness immediately shaped themselves into phantoms for the eye, and by a process apparently no less inevitable, when thus once traced in faint and visionary colours, like writings in sympathetic ink, they were drawn out by the fierce chemistry of my dreams into insufferable splendour that fretted my heart. 2. This and all other changes in my dreams were accompanied by deep-seated anxiety and funereal melancholy, such as are wholly incommunicable by words. I seemed every night to descend, not metaphorically, but literally to descend, into chasms and sunless abysses, depth below depths, from which it seemed hopeless that I could ever reascend. Nor did I by waking feel that I had reascended. Why should I dwell upon this? For indeed the state of gloom which attended these gorgeous spectacles, amounting at last to utter darkness, as of some suicidal despondency, cannot be approached by words. 3. The sense of space and, in the end, the sense of time were both powerfully affected. Buildings, landscapes, etc. were exhibited in proportions so vast as the bodily eye is not fitted to receive. Space swelled and was amplified to an extent of unutterable and self-repeating infinity. This disturbed me very much less the vast expansion of time. Sometimes I seemed to have lived for 70 or 100 years in one night, nay, sometimes had feelings representative of a duration far beyond the limits of any human experience. 4. The minutest incidents of childhood or forgotten scenes of later years were often revived. I could not be said to recollect them, for if I had been told of them when awaking, I should not have been able to acknowledge them as parts of my past experience. But placed as they were before me in dreams like intuitions and clothed in all their evanescent circumstances and accompanying feelings, I recognize them instantaneously. I was once told by a near relative of mine that having in her childhood fallen into a river and being on the very verge of death, but for the assistance which reached her at the last critical moment, she saw in a moment her whole life clothed in its forgotten incidents, arrayed before her as in a mirror, not successively, but simultaneously. And she had a faculty developed as suddenly for comprehending the whole and every part. This, from some opium experiences, I can believe. I have indeed seen the same thing asserted twice in modern books and accompanied by a remark which is probably true, viz., that the dread book of account which the scriptures speak of is in fact the mind itself of each individual. Of this, at least, I feel assured, that there is no such thing as ultimate forgetting. Traces once impressed upon the memory are indestructible. A thousand accidents may and will interpose a veil between our present consciousness and the secret inscriptions on the mind. Accidents of the same sort will also rend away this veil. But alike, whether veiled or unveiled, the inscription remains forever. Just as the stars seem to withdraw before the common light of day, whereas in fact we all know that it is the light which is drawn over them as a veil, and that they are awaiting to be revealed whenever the obscuring daylight itself shall have withdrawn. That's a quote from Thomas de Quincey, Confessions of an English Opium Eater. Dreams, the subconscious, and how our minds work are all featured in this abridged excerpt from Thomas de Quincey's book. Fear of the dark and the phantoms our imaginations may hold in store for us are all part of the essential reality of going to sleep in our bedrooms. The nature of how we perceive time in a linear fashion and how that is warped and changed when we dream, hallucinate, and perhaps just before we die. The waking world is clearly defined in the light with sharp edges, and then in darkness we are plunged into another less distinct world where we must feel our way sightless but for our overactive imaginations. Let us now slip into your bedroom and have a look at what this may represent in your life. This is the room where we sleep, and occasionally some of us make love in here as well. Beginning with sleep, as this is what we mostly do here, if we are lucky, this room reflects our most common, intimate, and vulnerable states. We do not invite unwelcome strangers into our bedrooms, and we generally do not sleep when we are not relaxed and feeling unsafe. Our bedrooms are often private areas reserved for ourselves, intimate partners, and special guests. This room reveals a sub-personality stripped of much of the public performance we take out onto the streets. This is ourselves paired back to a more essential self, where generally what you see is what you get, and mostly there is only one set of eyes looking at us. Have a look around your bedroom now. What colours are predominantly seen? Immediately, this tells us about our feelings for our bedroom space, what emotions are running through us in terms of our relationship to our unconscious, our dream time. Is your bedroom a big space or a cozy one? Our bedroom can be viewed as a departure platform or airport lounge for journeys about to embark into the subconscious realms. Is your bedroom well appointed? Does the bed take up much of the room? Is it a big bed, king or queen size? Is it a high bed or low to the ground, Japanese style? All of these things point to our relationship with our unconscious self. Is it a happy one or a troubled one? If you find a few negative answers re the bedroom, then it may be the case that you have an uneasy relationship with your unconscious, as this is what mainly goes on when you are sleeping. The conscious computer shuts down and the much larger subconscious mainframe opens up and runs the dream program. How we feel about ourselves deep down can often be revealed by our relationship to sleeping. Do you fall asleep easily? Or do you need to knock yourself out with something like drugs or alcohol? The use of sedatives and narcotics around sleep time will obviously impact on the state of your bedroom and your state of mind upon waking, the transition back from the subconscious state. Is your bedroom well ordered or more comfortably arranged? Pillows, throw rugs, silks, satins, or something else? The shape and arrangement of the things within your bedroom can offer clues as to how you cope with the shift from waking to sleep. Is your bedroom scattered with discarded clothes, these remnants of your disrobing prior to the shift from waking to the soma of sleep, can often be an indication of a challenging relationship with your inner self, or more correctly with the transition from public you to private you. We all know the call to perform when out and about in social situations, at work or at the bus stop, the requisite need to acknowledge with a smile or small talk those around us sharing the space. For some of us, these public performances are more difficult than for others. And then when we return home to ourselves, there can almost be a jet lag-like delay or resistance in returning to a more real space within ourselves. Intimacy issues can occur within us, outside of one-to-one relationships. The bedroom is the space to convey our state of play, re-intimacy. Windows. Does your bedroom have a view? The looking out in a space designed for the closing of eyes and looking inwards can sometimes convey a certain level of denial about the mini-death nature of sleep. Is your bedroom naturally lit or well lit with lamps? What are your feelings around falling asleep? Do you fear it? Do you fight it and internally rage against the going down of the sun? The outer-orientated personality often has trouble with the transition to the unconscious world. Does your bedroom offer soft furnishings or something more austere? Is sleep something that steals into your bedroom and seduces you in the night with its murmurings of nothingness and sheer delight? Or is sleep a bitter pill that you must take every night like Socrates and wait like him for the numbing sensation to slowly encapsulate your body before it finally obliterates your conscious mind? What does your bedroom tell you about yourself? How important is, in the scheme of things, is your bedroom? How much time do you spend in here? What is the quality of your sleep? Do you enjoy sleeping? These questions, properly answered, can put you on a path to understanding much about your relationship to your shadowy subconscious self. We can never really know with our conscious minds what happens in the unconscious realm, but we can sense our relationship to that deeper universe. We can see how much we value, what we bring back from our nightly visits to the sleep keeper, and where we download this information within ourselves. The brightly lit certainties of scientific fact know remarkably little about what happens and where we go when we sleep. Medical science still does not understand what happens within our brains during anesthesia, or why it actually works. The fact that we spend around 30% of our lives asleep in a state we do not really fully understand suggests that our minds remain an unexplored bastion. The classical world of the ancient Greeks had an interesting relationship with the concept of sleep. Aristotle wrote on sleep and sleeplessness, expounding on the importance of sleep to all animals, not just us humans. Also about dreams and the nature of dreaming, whether it was truly prophetic or not. He was very concerned with the dual nature of body and soul. And I suppose that it is when we are sleeping and dreaming in particular that our consciousness seems most separated from our body and could possibly have a life of its own. The age-old question has always been, where do we go when we dream? And are our dreams real or at least prophetic? Physiologically speaking, we burn up a good amount of energy when we are dreaming, so something must be going on. We now know about REM or rapid eye movement as an indicator of the type of brain activity happening in the pons or pontine brainstem. We go into REM sleep about 4 or 5 times on average a night. So dreams are not originating in our upper brains, the cerebral cortex, but coming from our more instinctive lower brain region, linking them to our evolutionary past. Some neuroscientists today postulate that dreaming may be a kind of hard drive file sorting, to use a computer analogy, where our brains are storing and cataloguing memories and thoughts, deciding what to keep handy and what to not. However, the evolutionary origin of dreaming may have been involved in something much closer to our very survival, shown by how physiologically affected we are during dreaming and how our brain stem is directly linked to the fight or flight phenomenon. We may be learning things on an instinctive response level whilst we are dreaming, deepening our experience of things that may be dangerous, like love, for instance. Now that we have tamed and eradicated most of our predators, there may not be anything quite as dangerous left in our modern world as romantic love / lust. We all experience these deep psychosexual dreams involving all sorts of characters from our lives. Sigmund Freud, of course, spent a great deal of his career analysing sexual dreams, and Jung carried on taking dream analysis into the archetypal realm, bringing God into the picture. Both Freud and Jung wrote much about the wish-fulfillment nature inherent in dreams, and I would posit that we have all had dreams about things we wish were so in our waking reality, but were not so. Our dream world has a different set of rules where we are definitely not in charge, but where we are occasionally involved with whom we would wish to be, often having an intense sexual experience. Freud wrote, "The more one is occupied with the solution of dreams, the more willing one must become to acknowledge that the majority of dreams of adults treat sexual material and give expression to erotic wishes." I think that what is borne out from Freud's dream analysis work is that whatever reality is suppressed from normal waking life will flourish in our dream life, so that, during Freud's day in the late 19th century, early 20th century, sexuality was on the whole hidden from daily middle-class public life, and so grew like rampant weeds in the garden of our subconscious, especially for women of this time who were culturally expected to have no sexual consciousness. A great deal of Freud's dream analysis was carried out on women. I think today, with the prevalence of sexual images in our media and online, that on the whole, there would be far less emphasis on sex in our dream life, depending, of course, on the age and circumstances of the subjects. If sex is everywhere you look in the waking world, selling stuff, then there is no need to dream about it. Jung was keen to break out of the restrictive Freudian dream symbology of anything long being a phallic image and anything with an opening or round being a vagina. He said, "I leave theory aside as much as possible when analysing dreams. Not entirely, of course, for we always need some theory to make things intelligible. It is on the basis of theory, for instance, that I expect dreams to have a meaning. But I have to make such an hypothesis in order to find the courage to deal with dreams at all. Since I have no reason to believe that the unconscious has any intention of concealing things, I must be careful not to project such a device on its activity. It is characteristic of dreams to prefer pictorial and picturesque language to colourless and merely rational statements. This is certainly not an intentional concealment. It simply emphasises our inability to understand the emotionally charged picture language of dreams." Now that we know a great deal more about the cerebral hemispheres of the brain, we are aware that the right brain conceives in pictures and is heavily involved in dreaming, neurophysiologist Alan Hobson showed that the brain stem, or lower instinctive brain, is responsible for generating the information or content in our dreams, and that this is then processed cerebrally as if it was coming from our sensory organs, our eyes and ears, etc. Alan Hobson wrote, "Dreaming has fascinated and mystified humankind for ages. The bizarre and evanescent qualities of dreams have invited boundless speculation about their origin, meaning, and purpose. For most of the 20th century, scientific dream theories were mainly psychological. Since the discovery of rapid eye movement, sleep, the neural underpinnings of dreaming have become increasingly well understood, and it is now possible to complement the details of these brain mechanisms with a theory of consciousness that is derived from the study of dreaming. The theory advanced here emphasizes data that suggests that REM sleep may constitute a proto-conscious state, providing a virtual reality model of the world that is of functional use to the development and maintenance of waking consciousness." Whether he is correct in his scientifically based assumptions in relation to dreaming being a proto-conscious state is still highly debatable, but it is a very engaging explanation. We spend a great deal of our lives asleep and dreaming, so whatever is occurring has a sizable effect upon our sense of who we are and our well-being. Take the time to pay attention to the dreams you remember, good or bad, as they are a message of some kind. The importance may not be in the symbolic language, but simply in their noticeable existence, like a flashing warning light on your dashboard inside your car. I agree with Jung in regard to dream symbology. Avoid tight definitions of dream symbols and find the symbols and meanings which are idiosyncratically yours. Develop your own pantheon of gods within the stories that are your life stories. You cannot find true meaning in some off-the-shelf cookbook of dream symbols, especially as they often include an encyclopedia-like format, which magpie definitions from widely divergent cultural sources, of which you may not be part of. There are archetypal symbols, which perhaps do have meaning for humanity as a whole, but without investigation on your own behalf, the process is not nearly as rich and psychologically as rewarding. Returning to our examination of the bedroom, and in particular the colours in your bedroom, as they can tell you a lot about yourself. What colours do you like around you when you fall asleep? Are they healing, soothing colours? If not, perhaps changing the colours to blues and greens may help your relationship with your unconscious, if you are having difficulty falling asleep or staying asleep. Or perhaps something more neutral like creams or white may do the job. Becoming more aware of the colours that surround you at any particular time is advisable, as they have such a powerful influence over your subtle energetic self. And when we refer to them as subtle, it is not because they are weak, it is actually because they are so all-pervasive that we often cannot readily isolate their effect upon us. Similarly, to sleep, sexual activity is another soma-like dimension or inner realm. Sex can be a mystical gateway to a boundless place of untold pleasures and exquisite pains. Sex, I think, is different things at different times of our lives. It reflects what we are seeking at that juncture, and therefore who we are attracting into our life, for it is a union of energies after all. Occasionally, that saying, "It takes two to tango, baby," has some negative connotations, and similarly our sexual experiences can at times be defined by our partner's energies for good or bad. Making love, having sex, it is a moment when we return to our interior universe and tune into our sensory responses. It is an intensely personal experience which is also shared in an intimate revelation of our essentially animal natures. We roar and groan, grunt and gasp in a symphony of respiratory action, for our ride to pleasure is carried on each breath. It is that breath which makes sexual activity a possible doorway to the divine. Reading Tim Winton's novel Breath, you can sense the parallels between experiences of the ocean and sexual experiences. Metaphorical language used to describe the tumbling, submerged qualities inherent inside a wave are similar to the ocean of bliss inside us, which can well up during sex. At times we are letting go to the inextricable force of the sea, as we must let go to the surging currents within our sexuality. We ride upon and inside our wave of ecstasy, and our breathing triggers the biochemical reactions which can awaken orgasmic brain activity. Sex is most often heightened at the beginning of a relationship when two individuals come together as strangers and begin a process of removing outer signs of independent identity. Clothing, which like a uniform represents each individual's place and possibly role in society, is stripped away and they stand naked before one another. Clothing can hide essential truths about who we are and allow us to pretend to be someone we are not. Sex asks of us, right at the start, to play the hand we have been dealt by nature. Sex asks us to bring the bare truth to this union as the key to opening a doorway to bliss. Our feelings at the beginning can be on a knife edge as we show parts of ourselves normally well hidden and vacillate between hopes and fears regarding our acceptance by the beloved. We are not only showing our ass in public, but celebrating its function and uses with another. It is a merging process as we share and discover our erogenous nooks and crannies with another. Our normally vigilant guard comes down and our pupils dilate as we hold the gaze of our lover and drink in the cause of this new delight. There is the magic of the unknown in the air, and it is charged with the frisson of the archetypal merging moment. There is glory and boldness, and there is surrender and humbleness. There is the charging of the stag with antlers aquiver and the dissolving into an endless ocean of energy. There are intense moments of you and equally intense moments beyond you. There is the ride and there is the fall. Once committed to the fruitful sexual act and thus rewarded with acceptance by our new sexual partner, we bring a sense of hope and with it the possibility of a clean slate in regard to an ongoing mutually rewarding physical and emotional relationship. For gateway sex, as I call it, is a magical sacred space, and we can only access it when we have hope in our heart. The sexual realm can ask all of us to embody archetypal energies no longer displayed by our genders in the modern age. It can create a dichotomy or unresolvable dynamic tension where what we play out sexually can never quite fit into the rest of our lives. It has a special place and demands distinct rules around it for it to survive and prosper in the 21st century. So many relationships break down here as the magic fades in the harsh light of the day and countless tiny grievances mount up to close the heart away. Once that heart and hope are locked away, then sex becomes a macabre shadow dance where the bodies go through the motions but with no soul at play. It can be like someone has switched off all the nerve endings and, more importantly, all the meaning from the activity. It is like making love whilst encased in a thick glove of suspended despair. The individual has returned to that individual space and no merging is possible anymore. When love dies, it is a very sad day, and our consciousness run endless reruns of the sepia-tinted memories to drive all joy away. Grieving the loss of love is probably the most traumatic experience we all will experience in our lifetimes. Like the bush after a fire, everything is black and burnt away. There are skeletons of trees which mark how high our joy once reached. The echo of love's once keen laughter keeps the birds at bay. For a time, nothing new will grow here, and the skies are always grey. Many of us have put away the magic of sex into the bottom drawer of an old cupboard which we never use anymore. Somewhere inside of us, we have sworn off this disrupting force and condemned that last great hurt to be the final one. We may masturbate ourselves, often or not, but without the emotional commitment of another's fumbling touch. Sex is a momentary relief to help us to get to sleep, or a frustrated release that doesn't stain the sheets quite as much. Layers of emotional scar tissue have built up hard upon our souls, and the smile we may offer another is firmly closed indoors. When and if love returns to these shores, it faces a long thaw and the messianic job of raising Lazarus from the dead. I know from my own personal experience that there can be a physical delay in being able to respond sexually after a long layoff. It is like those layers of calcified hurt must be given time to melt away before my penis will trust enough to fill with blood and stretch out to meet the new day. Returning now to that time when we have just established honest sexual union with our new partner and that sense of being in love is reciprocated, can you remember what it was like? When every part of their body is simply amazing and emanating some intangible quality. To touch their skin is the greatest pleasure you have ever known, and it is all holistically connected with some cosmic secret that you just had no idea about it before it happened. When you wake up in the morning and glance over at this beatific being lying next to you, and the realization hits that you and he or she are together, this is the magic realm, and it is often bittersweet for our cynical selves to recall this state of in-loveness. We have developed the habit of putting down such heightened states, labeling them as the honeymoon period, and quickly assuring the occupants that it will be over before you know it. You cannot stay too long in fairyland, and Peter Pan must grow up to face the grim realities of a real relationship. Yet today, even in the age of fast food marriages and divorces, we still clamour to be in love, and now the internet has brought the supermarket experience to shopping for love and relationships. How do we integrate magic into our humdrum lives? How do we honour the gods in our lovers and in ourselves? Can we maintain a sense of reality? Can we go to work, support the family, clean the bathroom, listen to the gripers and whingers in the average world, and still delve into the delicious, dripping divinity of another realm? Is sex a mystical gateway to a boundless place of untold pleasures and exquisite pains in your life? Indeed, what colours do you have in your boudoir for making love? Feng Shui recommends placing something red under the bed if you feel your lovemaking is lacking passion and excitement. Bedrooms in the houses of heterosexual married couples often reflect the woman's sensibilities because she is the one who most often maintains the space and quite possibly is the one who is most awake to its importance. So there will often be a real feminine emphasis on the furnishings and aesthetics in this room. In some examples, it will be very feminine, quite often frilly and lacy, as it is here that this woman lets herself feel ultimately feminine. It is here that she will really let her partner in, and here become essentially a woman. Especially now, as we live in a less and less feminine world, with masculine qualities appreciated in so many facets of modern life, the bedroom quite often remains a sacred space, as it is home to two sacred activities: sleep and lovemaking. Here are some things we can do to transform our bedroom. The first thing I advise in regard to your bedroom is to make sure that what you are really using it for as a bedroom. Don't fill your bedroom with unnecessary stuff. Resist turning it into an alternate entertainment facility with a lot of electrical equipment like TVs, sound systems, and digital clocks, etc. It is not great to have a lot of electromagnetic energy fields around you all the time, and especially whilst you are asleep. Keep the bedroom simply as a beautiful room with a bed in it, as a place you go to fall asleep in and or make love. Multitasking is very overrated and does not really work when it comes to the really important things in life. The simpler a task is, the more it requires your full attention. Sleeping and moving from waking consciousness to sleeping are a series of delicate processes. If you are not using drugs and alcohol to deaden the experience, insomnia is very prevalent in our Western urban communities, as we are so hyped up with continual digital visual stimulation, caffeine, city noise, and a 24/7 attitude fueled by technology. Our bedrooms need to return to their temple antecedents and become bare of the bullshit of our waking lives. Create a space where you can feel safe, loved, and able to be vulnerable. Find soothing colours to adorn the space, colours that speak of retreat and retirement from the hubbub, colours which whisper, go to sleep. I close my eyes and open the inner door to a place of calm and contented dark. I release my breath to free and easy, letting go of control and thoughts of more. I surrender to the mists of soma, to the floating cessation of senses no more. Sleep, 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 and sleep some more. I hope you enjoyed the fourth installment of House Therapy. Just a reminder that this podcast contains excerpts from the book House Therapy, Discovering Who You Truly Are at Home, and that book's available for purchase as an ebook at a variety of places at housetherapy.com.au. Thank you very much.